Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me are...
Devendra Hardwire.
And Jeff Cannata.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Today, what we're going to be doing on this podcast is talking about what we've been watching. We have just one piece of film news we're going to discuss. We're going to move on into an in-depth review. This week, we'll be talking about Edgar Wright's newest film, Baby Driver. Baby Driver, which at this moment looks to be his biggest movie domestically from a box office perspective.
Nice.
So, very excited about that. We've been fans of Edgar Wright for a very long time, and this is the first time he's doing something that's really not a comedy. So lots to discuss today on the Slash Filmcast.
Hey, Dave. Yeah? You know, I bet there are some new listeners that have stayed around after our Transformers review, maybe some fans of Paul's that are maybe sticking around and listening to the show for the very second time. So I wanted to welcome them and say thanks for hanging out. This is going to be one of our more usual formatted shows.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. We don't usually spend an hour 40 minutes trashing one movie plot point.
I mean, more often than not.
Sometimes.
But welcome to the show, everyone. And yes, of course, we did have Paul Scheer from How Did This Get Made on the podcast last week. Super fun episode, and an episode that was supposed to benefit, not only was supposed to,
We decided to just pocket the money.
Did benefit LA Children's Hospital. You can find the episode at slashfilmcast.com. You can find the fundraiser we did at gofundme.com/formers. That's gofundme.com/formers. There's still a chance to donate to that episode. I'm pretty sure I know the numbers for that episode, and I know how many people donated to that GoFundMe. And so I think there's still a lot of people who have listened to that episode who have not donated to the GoFundMe yet. There's still time to do so. We'll leave that GoFundMe open through July.
Can I tell you a little funny anecdote?
Tell us a funny anecdote, Jeff.
So all of the money that we raised for that episode is going to LA Children's Hospital.
Yep.
And just yesterday – after that episode came out, we were getting lots of great feedback about it, people talking about it, people donating. It was just really riding a wave of positivity and goodwill. It was great. And then I go to my mailbox and I open up my mailbox and lo and behold, what's in there? A letter from LA Children's Hospital. And I was like, what is this? This is serendipity. And I open it up and it's a bill for – when I took my son to LA Children's Hospital not too long ago. And I was like, oh, I guess I can't just that we just raised $8,000 for him.
You can't transfer that money out of the GoFundMe, unfortunately.
I was a little bummed by that. I was like, yeah. Guys, you're bleeding me dry here, LA Children's Hospital.
Well, they do great work. I mean, was it a good visit, Jeff, that you had?
Absolutely. I mean, it is. It's proof that you know I would take my own son there because I did, and they do amazing things. And we needed to see a specialist, which is why we went there. So anyway, I just thought it was kind of a funny serendipity of all the timing. Yeah.
Well, again, really had a blast with that episode. I re-listened to it, and it was just a lot of fun to hear Paul completely rip that movie apart. And I'm really glad to our listeners who, without whom we would not have seen Transformers the last night. Like, we just would not have watched that movie. So,
and we probably wouldn't have even had that idea had some intrepid listeners, suggested that they pay us to see it.
So thanks to all the people on Twitter who tweeted us. Thanks to people in the Slack Filmcast who mentioned it to us. We really appreciate it, guys. All right. So again, gofundme.com/formers. You can still contribute. It is not too late. But all right, we've been asking you guys to donate to the GoFundMe, and we also ask you guys to donate to the Slash Filmcast. So let's do something in return. This week, we are giving away 5 copies of The Fate of the Furious on Blu-ray. This is the most recent Fast and Furious movie. We all know that the best way to watch these movies is on Blu-ray. I mean, you got the highest fidelity possible, all the special features.
Yeah. You can't contain The Rock in a stream.
Yeah, you can't stream Vin Diesel. You gotta use all the special area on the Blu-ray to spread out your diesel.
All the D's.
Yeah. Agreed, gentlemen. Agreed. So we got 5 copies of the Blu-ray of Fate of the Furious to give away to some intrepid listeners, some fans of the show. And I mean, I also want to mention before we do this that the Blu-ray will be available for everyone on July 11th, 2017. It's also streaming right now on digital HD. So as of this podcast, you can actually get it on digital HD. But this Blu-ray will be out on July 11th, along with the DVD copy, the on-demand, as well as the 4K Ultra HD. But this is just the Blu-ray that we're talking about today. So if you want to enter to win one of these five Fate of the Furious Blu-rays, you got to do two things. Number one, got to leave a review for the Slash Filmcast on our iTunes page. And I believe if you go to slashfilmcast.com, that should take you straight to the iTunes page. So just go to slashfilmcast.com and leave a review for this podcast on the iTunes page. Now, I know what longtime listeners are saying. Hey, Dave, I already left a review for you guys like 5 years ago. Well, no need to worry. Step two is just take a screenshot of that review. If you've already left us a review, that's fine. You know, if you haven't left us a review, take a screenshot of your review and send it to slashfilmcast@gmail.com with Fate Contest in the subject line. So screen cap the review, send it to us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. I will be checking each one of these, so please actually leave a review or actually screenshot your review to be entered into the contest. Again, slashfilmcast@gmail.com with Fate Contest in the subject line. Entries due by Friday, July 7th, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time. And unfortunately, this is only open to the U.S., so international folks are out of luck for this contest. But for this contest, step one, leave us a review on our iTunes page. Step two, screen cap the review, send it to us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com with Fate Contest in the subject line. Entries due by Friday, July 7th, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time, U.S. only. And we will randomly select a winner and announce it on next week's podcast. I should say five winners.
I think you should leave us a review on the iTunes page as a character from Fate of the Furious.
From
their perspective, like how would they feel?
I'm not going to deny that would give you bonus points. You know? I'm not going
to
deny.
You don't have to pick the marquee characters. You can pick a obscure character from the film. But I think how would they? What would they think about our show?
Yeah, or another thing you could do is do the iTunes review, but only using car terms. You know,
only using car terms.
Only
like
speaking in car, or as Jeff Kanata coined it.
Most important thing. Only speaking car. The most important thing is family, but the second most important thing is a Slash Filmcast.
Yes, that's right.
Something like that.
That's right.
Along those lines.
All right, guys. So, Fate of the Furious, five copies of the Blu-ray. Looking forward to seeing those reviews and sending out those Blu-rays. All right, let's move on to the rest of the show. What have we been watching this week? Let's just talk briefly about that. I wanted to mention some TV shows that I've finished watching. Master of None, Season 2. Jeff, you just started this. Devinder, have you finished Master of None season 2?
Oh yeah, I mean that first weekend. How could you not?
This is one of the most incredible television experiences I've had in 2017. It's a brilliant show. I will say this: I think season 2 is a bit more uneven than season 1. I thought season 1 was extremely consistent. Every episode was awesome in season 1. But season 2, not as consistent. There were a couple of duds in there, but when season 2 hits, it is incredible. Like, the highs of season 2 are way higher than the highs of season 1, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to know what you're thinking is a dud, because I actually think it's all more memorable to me than season 1, even though I love so much of season 1. Like, to me, it felt like an upgrade in every way, except for, Aziz Ansari wants to really paint these grand romantic stories, and I didn't quite buy that this time.
Oh, I bought it completely. I loved
it. It's definitely up your alley, Dave.
Up my alley. I actually wrote this like very lengthy blog post at davechen.net explaining what my favorite episodes of the show are, and I really like opened up about how it relates to my my life as an immigrant. And actually, I, at this moment, I don't think it's going to be true when you're listening to this, but at this moment, if you Google Master of None, it is on the first page of Google results. So I'm really happy about that. But I'll just mention my favorite episodes really quickly without saying anything from the plot, because I know Jeff Cannata has yet to get to these episodes. But season 2, episode 4, First Date, I thought was really well executed. Mm-hmm. Season 2, episode 8, Thanksgiving. That is an episode that is so beautiful that I just was left in tears. Just tears. And I needed to take like 20, 30 minutes to just think about it after I finished watching it. It's just, it's so beautiful, so profound. Season 2, episode 8, Thanksgiving. And then the final two episodes of the season, just masterful, no pun intended. I thought it was brilliant, and the ending is perfect. And it just, the whole season is incredible overall, in my opinion, and would highly recommend you check it out on Netflix.
Yeah, I'm catching up right now with my wife. We're just kind of finishing out season one, and I love it. I, one of the things that I notice about the show that I think is so refreshing and makes it stand out and makes it such a breath of fresh air on television, quite honestly, is that very little of the comedy in Master of None comes from being mean. It's not sarcastic. It's not ironic. It's not mean-spirited. It's not insulting other people. It's not one person undermining another person. It really proves that you can sort of be wholesome and positive and feel good about your fellow man and still be funny. And so much of television over the last 10 to 20 years has just gone farther and farther down the road of being – sort, you know, sarcastic to the point of insulting to the characters, to each other, and everybody's trying to undermine each other, and that can be fun and funny for a while, but it's so nice to see comedy able to do something like this.
Mm-hmm. There's such a sweet heart to this show, and I think even more in season two. There's one episode I like that goes through like several vignettes throughout different New Yorkers, including a section. I guess it's probably not even worth spoiling. I think it does something with something really interesting, like yeah. with a disability
with people
that I don't
who usually
think is
don't
very
see
normal.
On screen, basically. Yeah, So
it shows us a lot of new things. Yeah,
yeah, a lot of interesting chances this season takes, and I think almost all of them are like handsomely rewarded, the chances that it takes. And so, absolutely love the show, but I'm really bummed because Aziz Ansari has said there might not be a third season. You know that This has basically captured this period of his life. And, you know, unless he has something new he wants to say, this is probably it for Master of None. That's a bummer, but, you know, you want to go out on a high note. You want to go out, leaving them wanting more. And I think Master of None season 2 on Netflix certainly does that. So, do you want to mention that? I finished Veep on HBO this week. I just wanted to say that I didn't really like the season as much as others, but it just has gotten so beyond the fact that real life has outpaced it in terms of how ridiculous it is. I feel it has gotten so mean spirited in a way that previous seasons weren't. And
I mean, it always really was, but I guess it balanced it in a better way.
The showrunner David Mandel has said that, oh, if you think that this season is harsher, you don't know what you're talking about. Like the earlier seasons were also extremely harsh. I don't know about that. Like, I feel like, yes, he was always a terrible person, but, like, the levels of heartlessness that happen in this season are beyond anything that we've seen before. But that being said, the arc of the season is tragic, and I did really appreciate the tragedy of the finale, and I'm just going to leave it at that without saying anything else. Veep season, I think they're on season 5 now? 6? I thought was very good. Season 6 is the most recent season. So, and finally, wanted to mention Silicon Valley, the most recent season. Saw the finale of the most recent season and wanted to just say a couple things about it. Number one, I thought Stephen Tobolowsky was awesome in this season. They gave him like a much bigger role than they did in previous seasons, and he's very funny. He did a Steve Ballmer impression, bizarrely, in one of the episodes. It was crazy. So I thought he was very good and, you know, really appreciate his work in this season. Overall, was kind of disappointed with this season as well. I feel like it's just like the show has started to feel very repetitive.
Oh, know? Yeah. Yeah, success, failure.
Unearned success, failure. Deus Ex Machina's out the wazoo. And then just like resetting the dynamic between characters that, you know, we've seen over and over again. But the one thing that really mixed things up is it was announced this past week, minor spoilers if you haven't heard the casting news, that TJ Miller, who plays Ehrlich Bachman on the show, is not returning to the next season of Silicon Valley. I'm not going to talk about how the circumstances under which the character left the show, other than to say it was extremely weak and underwhelming. I will mention that he gave a review to The Hollywood Reporter that was released as we were recording the last episode of the podcast. And did you guys read this interview?
Oh, yeah,
it's insane.
Pretty brutal. He comes out like very strongly against Alec Berg, who's one of the showrunners. He makes several digs against his co-star Thomas Middleditch, who plays the main character Richard Hendricks on the show. And just so we know what we're talking about, I'll just read one of the quotes here about Thomas Middleditch. He says here. In the interview, TJ Miller says, "I'm not an actor." And the interviewer says, "What do you mean you're not an actor?" He says, quote, "I'm not an actor. I'm a comedian. And I don't know how the fuck I hoodwinked Hollywood into giving me a career in this. But I'm not sitting here saying I need more lines. I'm not funny enough. I'm not Thomas Middleditch." End quote. So pretty brutal.
Yeesh.
Not typically how you would see someone talk about a show they just left. It is a very bizarre decision to leave a show at the height of its popularity, and you know, regular acting work is hard to come by. But apparently he's a nihilist, and so this is totally in keeping with his MO. We've also heard from many people, that, like many sources, that he was a huge pain in the ass to work with on the set, and people are very relieved that he's not going to be in the next season. So it's unfortunate that it went down like that. They did Ehrlich Bachman wrong on the show, in my opinion. Like, it was really an ignominious end for that character. It's a bummer that he won't be back, that he couldn't work things out with the cast and crew. But just wanted to acknowledge that as we move on in this show. So, Silicon Valley.
Well, it worked for Shelley Long. I'm sure it'll be great for him.
Shelley Long, remind me.
Cheers.
She left Cheers at the height of its popularity.
Yeah. Well, and went on to an amazing film career, right?
I was being a little sarcastic.
Talk about mean, Jeff.
I know. Meow. Talk about sarcasm as comedy. Meow. Who does that?
All right.
Only losers like me.
Anyway, let's move on.
I was just trying to think of any other actor that left us a comedy show on at the height of its popularity, and mm-hmm. Shelley Long did.
Topher Grace.
That was
the height of it. Yeah.
It's a lot of shows.
Actually, a lot of shows, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Devendra, what have you been watching?
Oh, I saw the first couple episodes of Glow, the new Netflix series from Liz Flahive. Don't know how to pronounce her name. And Carly Mensch. I believe they're two Orange is the New Black writers. This is a series about female wrestling in the 80s. And it is so good. I really like it. It stars Alison Brie as this young actress who just can't quite get any roles, and she finds herself in this wrestling thing. And Mark Maron as their coach, and he is so good in the show. Like, he is better in the show than the show named after him. So, which is kind of funny. But yeah, it's all about wrestling. It's a lot about these women's lives as well. Eventually the show starts to focus less on Alison Brie, so just like Orange is the New Black, and it opens up to tell us stories about all these different women who are doing this crazy wrestling thing. And I had actually never heard about this either, but Glow was a real thing. Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. I never saw Glow, and I used to watch wrestling as a kid. I just never saw Glow. It was a syndicated wrestling show. But yeah, just want to throw a shout out to this. I love the show. So well written. Dynamics are really great. And just like Orange is the New Black, I think it's just so unique. It is very nice to see a show that's just focused all about telling these women's stories. It gets the 80s kitsch just right. There is a talking robot, because of course there is. So I love all the kitsch of it too.
That's Glow. It's on Netflix. Jeff, you've seen a couple episodes, right? What do you think?
Oh, so many people have sent me messages saying this show's your jam. I'm a closeted wrestling fan. Not so closeted.
I think it's very closeted. You've said many times on the show.
No. I only watch wrestling inside my closet.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
But I love wrestling still. And I'm a child of the 80s. I love the 80s. I love Marc Maron. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of things that sync up for me to love this, but hasn't clicked with me yet. I've only watched two episodes.
Oh yeah, keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what everybody says.
Things change a little.
The first one felt real clunky and contrived, and I didn't buy any of it. I mean, I know it's a comedy and I know it's a little heightened and stylized, but it just felt so contrived to sort of get all those people in that place, and I just didn't buy what mm-hmm. was happening. But and I didn't think the comedy was great, but I will stick with it and I will keep watching it because it's so much of my jam. And I agree with you that Marc Maron is the best thing I've ever seen him in.
He was born to play this role.
Yeah. He really was. And people are talking like he needs to play Stan Lee now in like the Stan Lee story. I just think that'd be so great.
Was this Stan Lee or Jack Kirby? I think one of them.
No, somebody was saying he needs to play Stan Lee, and then what's his name? The guy who played the bad guy in Wonder Woman.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Should play Jack Kirby. anyway, I got to stick with this one because it has not grabbed me yet.
All right, that's unfortunate. But Glow is available on Netflix. I've seen a lot of positive reviews for this one, and Devendra seems to be a big fan. How many episodes in are you guys?
About three episodes in right now, and yeah, okay. Things start to change quite a bit. And you know, as we're talking about Netflix shows too, also worth mentioning, like they're canceling a whole bunch of things now, which is a little uncharacteristic of them. So, you know, I think it's a good thing though. Like Lady Boss is one of the ones they just announced they're canceling, and that show's not good. So good. Like let's stop making bad TV and focus more on the good stuff.
Yeah, it is a bummer. They've been canceling a lot of shows, which is not something they've typically done in the past. Sense8, Devendra, have you heard about this whole?
Yes, Sense8. I did today.
It's crazy, guys. It's crazy. So they canceled Sense8, and then there's a huge fan campaign to bring it back. And they said Netflix came back and said, nope, sorry, we're not bringing it back. We really tried. We tried to make the numbers work. It's not happening. And then out of the ashes today, it was revealed that after Sense8 Season 2, there's going to be a two-hour finale that Netflix is going to run.
Awesome.
So are you caught up with Season 2, Devendra? How happy are you
with
this?
Yeah, it ended on a cliffhanger, and I'm very glad that there is a way to wrap up this story. Like, this is one of those things. The show is great. Not enough people have seen it, and it's kind of, you know, it's not everybody's jam. So I can understand why Netflix canceled it. I'm just glad that, yeah, we got this. This is something I don't think a typical TV network could do.
Yeah, I mean, Girl Boss, you were mentioning Sense8.
Oh yeah, Girl Boss.
And what did you say before? I think you said Lady Boss.
I said Lady Boss.
Yeah,
But they also canceled the other sad Will Arnett show, right?
Wait a minute, ladies can be bosses now?
Yeah, Lady Boss.
Flaked. I think they're not sure about that. Flaked did get a season two renewal. Mm-hmm. But
the show that I've been watching this week falls into that category too, fellas.
Mm-hmm.
Bloodline.
Oh yeah, Bloodline has been canceled after season 3, and also The Get Down canceled after season 1,
which is very disappointing.
That was a massive bet. I mean, they spent over $100 million.
So much money. Like, I love that show, guys, but it's kind of a mess. Yeah.
All right. Well, Jeff, tell us what you've been watching.
Well, I finished Bloodline season 3. Regular listeners of the show will know how high I am on Bloodline. It's one of my wife and I's favorite show. The first two seasons are some of the most taut, slow-burning, tension-filled episodes of TV I've ever seen. It is just really great. Ben Mendelsohn is on fire in this show. He's just unbelievably good. And Kyle Chandler's great. The dynamic of this family, I've often said this show could be called Lies because it's just about what it is to lie and what lying does and all of the ramifications of lie. It's just a deep dive into what lying will do to a family. In season 3, so went into season 3 with mixed emotions because I was excited to get a new season of Bloodline, but I was a little bummed that this is the third and final season. And they had originally planned for at least 5 seasons of Bloodline. That's what the showrunners had bibled out, you know, for the show Bible. And through eight episodes, so it's 10 episodes in season three. Episode eight is a crescendo. It is awesome. We learn something about one of the characters that's been around for the whole show that is feels like a rocket, you know, to the side of the face. It is just a gut shot, right? It is really powerful. It's just exactly what Bloodline has been over and over and over again. Kind of unexpected, slow burn that crescendos. And then there's two more episodes. And my wife and I turned to each other at the end of episode eight and went, how the hell are they going to wrap all the loose ends up in two episodes? And it turns out they don't. In fact, my wife downright got angry at the last two episodes of the show, to the point where like how I feel about Battlestar Galactica or Lost, whereas like the shows that I were loving just like shat the bed at the end. I don't feel that bad about it. Episode nine of season three of Bloodline is baffling to me. It is a complete departure from the show. It goes to places that the show has never done. It becomes this weird, enigmatic – it turns into Twin Peaks for a little bit. It's really weird. It doesn't progress anything. It doesn't give you any solid information about anything. And then episode 10 has this unenviable task of trying to end things. And it really does feel – I don't think I'm saying this just because I was armed with the knowledge that they wanted to do more seasons. It really does feel like they had all these ideas and they went, okay – let's jam them all in the last two episodes and show everybody where we were planning to go with all these characters really, really fast, because we knew where they were going to end up and we can get them there in two episodes. It'll be fine. Let's do it. And it just feels really clunky and bad. And it's such a disappointment for a show that I adore that they had to truncate it and make it feel so rushed and so unsatisfying. There are so many things that they were – leading up to in their typical slow burny way that just fizzle and completely get abandoned or shift gears and go in someplace else just because it felt like they didn't have time and they just wanted to shut it all down. And that is a massive disappointment.
Would you rather have not seen like where those plot lines were headed? Because they actually did this in Rome as well. Season two like got super rushed at the end and it kind of worked, although I still would have liked to see a more organic season there.
I mean – I know where all the characters end up now-ish, but I almost wish that the show had just ended with episode eight where, you know, there's this big trial that's happening in the whole season. Episode eight is the end of the trial, and that the show had just ended like that, it would have been fine. But then we have two more episodes, and episode nine honestly is one of the most frustrating hours of television because we are in a completely different show for a little while, and it is just feels like it's just spinning its wheels and – kind of insulting the audience that's been along for the ride for these many, many hours of TV. And then episode 10 is just bam, 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 bam. Let me give it all this information fast, 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 and doesn't do justice to any of it. It's really disappointing.
Well, Jeff, I think you just saved me 30 hours.
It's really good all the way through, but it's like the same thing. Like people are like, oh, should I watch Battlestar Galactica? I was like, yeah, but the second you hear Jimi Hendrix, stop watching. Just don't watch ever again.
So I should get through episode eight and just not stop watching? I can't do that. I can't do that. All right, anyway.
I couldn't even get into season two of Bloodline, honestly. Like, it just – it felt like, okay, I got that first mystery. That's good. I'm out. Tap out.
All right, guys. That's what we've been watching this week. Before we move on, can I just take a break here to tell you guys, like, I'm going – this is all – I'm still recording, but we're – I'm going to Con of Thrones this weekend, the Game of Thrones convention. I think the first ever Game of Thrones convention in Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm really excited about that. Unfortunately, by the time you're listening to this, I will have already done it. So you can't come and see me because it will have already happened. But I've loaded up a ton of movies and TV shows on my tablet. And I guess I just wanted to share it with you guys and, you know, see your reactions, you know.
Cool. Before you do that, I want to ask you one thing, because I always do this on trips and I almost never even barely scratch the surface of what I've prepared.
I think, you know, even if I spent every second watching something, I would only, you know, it would be like 5% of what I've actually loaded onto the tablet.
So what do you got?
All right, here's what I got. I got the new Bong Joon. So I got Netflix and I got Prime Video, and I got you know, Apple iTunes as well. So I got like all of those services. It's amazing, guys. Now you can watch movies offline now from all of those services. So it's pretty awesome. So
but I don't like where this is headed. You have Okja.
I have Okja on the tablet. That's right. The new Bong Joon-ho movie. I'm not going
to stop watching that, by the way. I had to stop watching that.
Oh, really? You didn't like it?
No.
Oh, wow. Okay. I was thinking that might be a future / filmcast review, but
we could if you want.
It would be nice, but also, God damn you, Dave, if you watch that movie on a tablet.
Okay.
We just talked
about how maybe it's going to happen, not definitely. all right. I have a bunch of movies like Little Men, The Tribe, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Oh, that's so good.
Like, which one?
Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
It's a good movie. It'll make you feel very, very sad. Yeah,
that's true.
I've started watching Headshot on my last plane ride, the Timo Jahanto movie, and I'm looking forward to finishing it on this plane ride.
That movie's also a lot of fun,
Sarah Silverman's Speck of Dust, Other People, the Molly Shannon movie.
So none of the TV series you need to catch up on. That's what I'm getting.
But the one that I'm really excited about is The Keepers, which I keep hearing about. 7 episodes of The Keepers I've loaded up, and I'm really looking forward to checking that out. So
still no Americans. Okay.
No Americans. Okay, so on Prime, my Prime Video, I got I Love Dick and Sneaky Pete.
Sneaky Pete is so good.
And Lion, I rented Lion for $1. I got Complete Unknown, the Rachel Weisz movie. Gleason, this documentary that'll probably make me really sad. Girl with All the Gifts, and Krisha, the first film by the guy who did It Comes at Night that we reviewed a couple weeks ago. So looking forward to those. And in terms of the iTunes, really like for iTunes, it's just like watching a lot of special features. So for instance, I got the new Heat Blu-ray and got the digital version has special features. And John Wick Chapter 2, looking forward to checking out the special features of that. And Arrival special features as well as Get Out special features. Like I've already seen all those movies. But I haven't seen the special features yet.
That's actually a great way to deal with some of those special features.
Yeah,
just take them on a plane or something.
Yeah.
I'd love to take them on, I don't know, consume them like podcasts almost.
I wish it was easier to consume them, like on the go or something like that. But iTunes file sizes are massive. Like every iTunes movie is 5 gigabytes, you know? And if you download the same movie on, you know, Amazon Prime or Netflix, it's like 800 megabytes. It's kind of a pain.
I have to ask, Dave, you have such a long backlog of TV shows that you actually should be watching. You have not even touched The Americans. Like, what are
I've
you
seen
doing?
The first, like, 8 episodes of The Americans.
Okay,
but,
But this is more
The Americans,
The Americans
is just too close to reality now.
So anyway, those are the things I'm planning on watching. Just thought you
How do you decide when you sit down on the plane and you go, oh, I have this smorgasbord in front of me.
And you just fall asleep.
That's what I do. I'm always like, oh, I'm so excited. Do you sort of play it by mood at the time? You're like, I'm just going to wait and see whatever mood I'm in at the time, what's going to strike my fancy?
Yeah, I mean, almost invariably, I end up watching the kind of stuff that you don't need to think about very much.
Right.
So, I have the Norm Macdonald, you know, Netflix special and the Sarah Silverman Netflix special. And those are things you can easily stop and start without disrupting the flow of things. I'm probably not going to watch Okja on the plane. I'm just going to put that out there.
I just feel like
I wanted the option, Devendra. I wanted the option.
Do you have noise canceling wireless headphones for the plane?
Yes,
those are essential.
Totally. Jeff, it's really like what mood I feel in, and usually the mood I feel in is I don't want to think too hard.
on your list of movies, all of them are thinkers.
Yeah, it's also what movie am I okay watching while I'm physically in distress, which is typically what, you know, a plane ride is like these days. So anyway.
By the way, I would also recommend Hassan Minhaj's
I have Hassan Minhaj's special on there.
So good.
I also got,
so good. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry.
Oh, nice. I also got Veer Das's new special on there. So I didn't read everything off because there's actually even more than what I read. Anyway, I appreciate you guys weighing in on it. Out of all those things I said, anything you think I should prioritize, guys?
I think the comedy things are really great for the plane.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
They're nice and light.
Jeff, what were you going to say?
No, I agree with that. I kind of spoke up when I heard things that I was all excited to be watching. But
there's also all these. So I also got Wet Hot American Summer. Like I never actually watched First Day.
The first
of
one?
No. The series on Netflix.
Ooh,
you've seen the film, right?
I've seen the film. Yep, seen the film.
Okay.
And there's also all these random Netflix movies that have piqued my interest, but that I've never just watched over time, like Tallulah, The Fundamentals of Caring with Paul Rudd. There's a new documentary called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. So, you know, next time we talk, I'll have watched some combination of some crazy-ass combination of all these movies. I'm probably going to watch Lion, which I rented on Amazon.
That sounds like a good plan movie, yeah.
And I was thinking of putting on The Handmaiden and making someone sitting next to me uncomfortable. We'll see.
It's so easy to do.
We'll see if that happens. All right. Anyway.
Somebody's going to call into the / film court and be like, Dave Chen was sitting next to me on a plane and it was weird.
Indeed. Indeed. I make it weird, Jeff. I make it weird. All right. Couple news stories we want to mention real quick before we get to our review of Baby Driver. Firstly, wanted to just give a shout out to Michael Nyquist. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, but he is an actor who I have really grown to enjoy in the last few years. You guys might remember him from Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. He was in the first John Wick movie. A lot of American audiences may have first been exposed to him in The Girl with Dragon Tattoo.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But
which I think he was better in than Daniel Craig, honestly.
Yeah. I think I might enjoy that performance more. Anyway, a great actor. I mean, this guy could do everything. You know, he could play a journalist in Girl with Dragon Tattoo. He was ex-Special Forces insane dude fighting Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Yep.
A great actor. He passed away at the age of 56. That's so young.
So sad.
So young, yeah. But really talented guy, and just wanted to take a moment to say his work is amazing and he will be missed. So, Michael Nyquist, you're awesome, and we have your body of work to remember you by. Let's also talk about this news of the Han Solo movie. Now, the recording times really don't line up for us to talk about this in a very effective way.
Right.
When we talked about it on last week's episode, news broke right after that Ron Howard was going to be directing the Han Solo movie. Since then, a lot of other details have spilled out. And of course, like, we're actually releasing this episode of the podcast, you know, the first week of July, so this will be very old by then. But hey, we're still going to talk about it anyway. We're recording this right now on June 29th. But so Ron Howard, guys.
Directing
the new Star Wars movies. What do you guys think? Any thoughts?
I have many feelings.
In the abstract, if you had just said, hey, Ron Howard is directing a Star Wars movie without any of the other story that's going along with it, a lot of hullabaloo that's accompanied it, I would be thrilled. I would be excited. I mean, this is the guy that brought us Willow, right? I mean, I would be very excited to see what Ron Howard does in that universe. I feel like he has been a fan of that universe and sort of one of those directors that brings, you know, fantasy kinds of grandiose stories to the screen in an effective way. But this is weird. Like, what is he going to do? This movie is basically shot. I know there's going to be lots of reshoots. How much Ron Howard is going to be here? What is this? This is such a messy topic. It doesn't really feel like a true Ron Howard Star Wars movie. It feels like he's there because he's solid and can fix things.
Mm-hmm. And they like him too. Like, I believe he was one of the people Lucas was looking at around the prequels too, if they were ever going to do other directors then. And he has the tie. That would have been interesting. The thing is, I find it hard. He's directed some great movies, like Apollo 13.
Apollo 13, probably one of my favorite movies of all time.
Seriously. You know, recently, Rush, I think he did a great job with Rush.
Yeah, Rush is a solid movie.
My big worry is that, he has been sort of slumming it with all the damn Da Vinci Code movies, and they're just not good. I'm sure they print money and they allow him to do a lot of other things, but they feel so lazy and so sad, and I just wish a little more could happen. Maybe a purely directed Ron Howard movie would be more exciting. I don't know how he's going to change this one. So it's all a little weird. And he's also doing Seven Eves, which is another like space related thing. Although it's more like Apollo 13 if it were a disaster movie. So I don't even know how that's all going to fit into this. I guess he's just going to do like the rush job and help finish this movie.
Yeah. So Ron Howard, again, he made some amazing films. Apollo 13, Frost Nixon, Rush. Some people like A Beautiful Mind. You know,
Cinderella Man. Yeah.
Cinderella Man. Like, guy who's made some great movies. But I think the most brutal assessment of this news was delivered by Keith Phipps over at UpRocks, who tweeted, "I'm surprised Lucasfilm is not worried that Ron Howard will overwhelm Han Solo with his signature directorial touches and abiding thematic obsessions." Which I just thought was, oh, that's brutal, you know?
So
because Ron Howard is these days regarded as kind of a – is journeyman the correct word, right? Like kind of this guy, like a very competent, skilled craftsman who doesn't necessarily have his own voice or obsessions. Like, it doesn't have something that he's desperately trying to communicate to the world. But is
other than Da Vinci's conspiracies.
Right.
Yeah.
But nonetheless is quite good at his job. A lot of interesting, this is a huge news story right now that's going on. And, there's been a lot of details that spilled out about this, in the last few weeks, or the last like week or so. The biggest one is essentially that Lord and Miller were making a comedy, you know, with Han Solo. Like they thought their job was to make a comedy, and what Lucasfilm was going for was a Star Wars film with comedic elements, and those are very different things, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Apparently tension on the set was high. Like people at Lucasfilm felt like they weren't getting the material they needed to put together the film that they wanted to put together. And, you know, Lord and Miller have a tendency to go on set and find the scene in the room, find the scene on set with the actors there. But it would lead to a lot of riffing, a lot of improvisation. And that's just not how Lawrence Kasdan and Kathleen Kennedy like to do things. Lawrence Kasdan, who has helped to shepherd this series for decades, he is very much of the belief that what you write in the script, that is what you film.
Well, he came out of the theater, right? He's used to people respecting the words.
Yeah. And that's not what Lord and Miller were delivering, right? They were riffing and
there's no improv in Body Heat.
Yeah. nice, Jeff. And so they, you know, Lord and Miller were chafing under this tight control that the producers were exerting, and of course they weren't going to play nice and just go quietly into that good night. But apparently the culture clashes started immediately. According to Variety, Kathleen Kennedy didn't even like the way they folded their socks. I think that was probably metaphorically speaking, but it just is like their styles were so dramatically different.
But you guys know that in Hollywood, the first thing that every director does is the laundry, right?
Yeah,
you know
that's right.
Always the process.
Also, apparently, Alden Ehrenreich, an acting coach, was brought in to help Alden Ehrenreich out. And that's usually not a big deal, but it is kind of a bigger deal when it happens well into shooting. I don't think necessarily it's because Alden Ehrenreich was not doing a good job, but just because there was a lot of conflicts about who Han Solo would actually be, you know?
Right.
Is he this jokester, that's just riffing all the time? Or is
there's such a great Hail Caesar joke here.
Right, yeah. Or is he the guy, they're trying to bring Han Solo to the point where he is the character at the beginning of Star Wars Episode 4. And I think there just might have been a huge disconnect there. It basically sounds like there was chaos in terms of – or not chaos, but great discomfort on the set of a producer or a set of producers and a set of directors that just were not aligned in terms of style or their vision for the film.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it sounds like these guys just weren't precious with the IP.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think the whole idea of bringing Kathleen Kennedy on was so that somebody would be around to be precious with the IP. And that's an interesting thing. I don't know what's more interesting, to have somebody kind of be a little more reckless with these great characters. I don't know. I kind of feel like they are a little precious to me, and you can't mess with them. I'm at the point now where like I legit just don't even want this Han Solo movie. Just don't do it. I mean, as much as I wanted to see young Lando, really, that's the most exciting part was seeing young Lando. But I at this point, just let Harrison Ford be Han Solo forever. Don't let any other actor play him. Just let it die. Just he comes into existence the moment we meet him in Mos Eisley. That's all we need to know.
Yeah, I mean this will go on for quite a while. You know, the Phil Lord and Chris Miller version of the film will become legend, right? I mean, it's going to be this.
And there's
movie.
Still going to be a lot of it there. They can't just axe this footage, right? So,
right.
It's going to. I'm imagining like weird ass tonal shifts, just like going from Ron Howard sentimentality to whoa, Lord and Miller doing some comedy here, and then back and forth. I don't know.
Yeah, but there will forever be talks about the version of the movie that was never finished and that we never saw. And that's a terrible situation for Ron Howard to be stepping in. Also, from a DGA perspective, it's unclear if Ron Howard will even be able to get credited as the director of this film. Because so much
I wonder
of it
if he's more like,
shot.
You know, guys, I'm going to do this, but give me my damn Chewbacca movie. Or something.
Ron Howard's always wanted the Chewbacca movie.
The Chewbacca movie, yes. He's all about the Wookiee.
Was that a
Limp Bizkit reference?
Sure, why not? Yeah.
It's a crazy story that's still unfolding. And yeah, I mean, the movie, it has a very challenging road ahead of it, in my opinion, after these developments have spilled out into the open. I mean, it's just a very unfortunate situation. Like from a fan perspective, you know, like you, Jeff, you're probably the biggest Star Wars fan on this podcast. You're saying, I don't want this movie anymore. I didn't want it at the beginning, to be honest. Yeah, but I think for a lot of other fans, like it will be, they'll forever question what this movie could have been. And that's just.
And you know, Lord and Miller will never do another interview again without getting a question about it.
Yeah.
It will follow them for the rest of their career.
Every single question on this film's press tour will be about Lord and Miller's contributions, you know, it's a challenging situation for Ron Howard to step into. But apparently people were really happy when he stepped into it. Like, there was a report that, the crew like applauded when, it was announced that Ron Howard would be, stepping in. Hold on, let me.
Well, he's a guy with a tremendous reputation and of a positive reputation of being good to people and, as being very skilled, as you've said. I mean, I bristle a little bit at people's sort of backhanded, like, well, you don't have a vision or whatever. I don't know. If I see that there's a new Ron Howard movie coming out, I immediately want to see it without even knowing anything about it. Just the fact that he's directing it, it usually indicates a level of quality, a base level of quality. And I know you guys are hard on the.
How did you like The Heart of the Sea, Jeff?
I didn't see it. I'll be honest with you.
What about Inferno?
I didn't see that either. But
Angels and Demons, Jeff.
Okay. So
I don't want to be a jerk. It's just more like this is I loved so much of what Ron Howard used to do, and I think what he's doing now has just been kind of
it's been kind of rough. It has not lived up to what we feel like his potential is, because we think he's a really talented guy. But yeah, just to quote, according to this story here, I'm reading at Vanity Fair now. The news was such a relief to the crew that Ron Howard was directing that they reportedly broke out into applause by the end of the new director announcement meeting, per the Hollywood Reporter, a celebration that was somber but in support of the movie. So
that must have been a rough time on set, too. Like, just like that limbo of you have no clue, you know, where this project is going to go.
Yeah. Insane. Very challenging. Very challenging time. Anyway, I don't know how to feel about this movie. You know, I don't know if I'm looking forward to it or not.
Yeah. The big problem is we know that this is all happening, and a lot of this happened with Rogue One, maybe not to the same extent, but
I'm interested to see if they can salvage this one. You know, I'm interested as a kind of intellectual exercise. I'm interested to see whether it's going to be good. You know,
Rogue One turned out great.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk also about, like, is this whole technique working of bringing these indie director or these, you know, kind of smaller directors onto these big films, because you've had
we want your voice but not so loud.
Yeah, Josh Trank, you got Lord and Miller, you got Gareth Edwards, and it's like this series is starting to become like not super appealing from a director standpoint if the producer control is so tight. But that's how they like things over there, you know? Same thing with Edgar Wright and Ant-Man, right? Like that was... Yeah.
Was Josh Trank doing the Han Solo one, or was that another...
No, he was doing something else, right?
Yeah, he was doing... He was going to do... Wasn't he going to do episode...
No, he was doing one of the spinoffs.
Yeah, he was doing one of the
Rogue
spinoffs.
Rogue One? Was he doing Rogue One?
I think it was the Han Solo movie.
I think that
really?
Might be... Yeah.
Yeah. This the movie is cursed.
If only we had the internet in front of us.
I'm looking. I just can't find like what specifically they're referring to.
You know, one of the interesting things about Ron Howard, though, also is I would be very surprised if they didn't ask JJ to do it first, right? So I would be very surprised if there was
save us JJ
wasn't to JJ, and he straight up must have said no. I mean, I'm basing this on nothing, but.
I don't think that's right at all, actually, because there was apparently like big clashes between JJ and the studio for episode 7, specifically about the release date around that movie. Like he wanted to push it back,
to make it more like A New Hope.
Here we go. I'm going to quote here from the Ankler newsletter by Richard Rushfield. Quote, of all the directors in this round of Star Wars films, J.J. Abrams had the most collegial relationship with Kennedy, coming to Lucasfilm as a top-tier A-list director and one who had known Kennedy since he was a teenage intern for Steven Spielberg. Nonetheless, the parting wasn't necessarily a happy one. J.J. wanted to be a producer on 8 and 9, and they wouldn't give it to him, an insider tells us. There is no love lost between those two.
Anyway. Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I've said it before. I think you're kind of saying it again. It is... This is a machine that's bigger than any one creative person.
Yeah.
And that is what you're – I mean Marvel is becoming that, and we're seeing those kind of clashes happening with Marvel movies as well when they – you know these creators who have a certain vision and want to express themselves through these characters get on. That's not really the job. The job is to serve the machine – create a quality product that fits into a very precise moving machine. And that's not an easy thing. You know who is great at doing that? Ron Howard.
Yeah, right. I'm sure. I think the Trank thing, by the way, was Boba Fett.
Boba Fett.
Because we did know about the Han Solo thing. Yeah.
But Jeff, that's a very good point. A lot of these franchises have now become producer driven. Right, they're very
by necessity.
It used to be that like television shows were very producer driven and films were very director driven. Like the director was the auteur; he had final cut. He would make all these decisions. That is no longer the case. That is no longer the case.
And that's because much like television, right? In television, you have a showrunner or a producer that's there the whole time, and they hire directors for individual episodes. Sound familiar?
Yeah,
that's what's going on now with movies, where you have universes of movies that need to be consistent episode to episode, and you have an episode of a Marvel property or an episode of a Star Wars property that needs to fit into a larger framework. That it's going to work like a television series by necessity.
Yeah, that makes sense. Movies are becoming more like TV, and TV is becoming more like movies.
It's
kind of weird.
Peter DeBruge actually wrote a great piece over Variety entitled "Why Movies Need Directors Like Phil Lord and Chris Miller More Than Ever." And he says here, do you want to know why Colin Trevorrow was picked to direct Jurassic World when his only previous credit was a nifty little sci-fi indie called Safety Not Guaranteed? It's because he plays well with others, willing to follow executive producer Steven Spielberg's lead when necessary. Going into the assignment, Trevorrow had no experience directing complicated action sequences or overseeing massive budget special effects. He didn't need it because those aspects of the movie were delegated to seasoned heads of the department. While Trevorrow focused on what he does best, handling the interpersonal chemistry between the lead characters. So, end quote. That's a great summary. Peter DeBruge paints a picture is that these producers are brought in to just put a little like kiss of their own like style on it, just a little like touch of the style on the movie, and that's
traffic cops. You know, they're saying stop and go, and that's.
They're not like Fate of the Furious, like F. Gary Gray, you know, the conclusion of that movie, the big ice chase sequence was shot before principal photography, before like they knew fully what the story of the movie would be, like all that stuff. So it's crazy how much of the cart comes before the horse.
I want you to write to the ice chase. That's all we care about. We got to get the ice chase in the movie.
Like imagine, yeah, imagine that, hey, there's an ice chase at the end of the movie, and like no matter what happens in this film, you need to arrive at that ice chase by the
end. They're being chased by a submarine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Blah, 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 ice chase, blah, 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 credits.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Cha-ching.
And that's how the money gets made. I mean, it's really a larger conversation about where we are with Hollywood, right? Where movies are billion-dollar endeavors that are larger than a creative process, and they, you know, unfortunately, they're part of universes, they're part of theme parks and toy lines and all these things, and they. And they serve a very specific purpose, and that purpose is money. And artistic freedom happens at a much lower price point for most people. Mm-hmm. There are a few directors that can still get away with it. You know, Christopher Nolan is one. But there are still directors that can be creative and make big things, but mostly big things aren't really creative. Big things are kind of prescribed.
Right. There are flashes of creativity in them.
Sure.
And they can be quite delightful.
Indeed. You know? I don't mean to imply otherwise, and I appreciate you saying that.
But that's why it's so rare that you have a movie like Baby Driver, which we're going to talk about in a second.
Mm-hmm.
It's just and Edgar Wright has spoken like about how challenging it is to get an original film made in theaters. It is a Herculean task these days.
Right.
And so a movie like Baby Driver even existing and that you can see it in the multiplex is a miracle, pretty much. But yeah, there are flashes of brilliance in even some of these big movies, and they can still be very enjoyable and play to some of the best aspects of those genres. But Jeff is right, you know, movies mm-hmm. product these days, and that's kind of what it's come down to.
I like how we're ending this as if Disney snipers were trained on our heads right now. Just like we like franchises.
Yes,
let us live.
You know what I like? I like mice. I love mice. They're so adorable.
I love worlds, fantastical worlds.
I love Lamp, guys. All right, let's move on. Thanks to all the people who donated to the Slash Filmcast this week. Thanks to Marcel Della Hyge from Rotterdam, Netherlands. Thanks to Christian Hain from Muskegon, Michigan, and Michael Crowder from the United Kingdom, as well as Mr. Keep Cursing if you feel inclined to do so. So that was in counter to the person who said we shouldn't curse. And Mikko Usitalo from Sweden. Thanks so much for your contributions. Thanks also to new subscribers, Shannon McCarthy, Chris Skourakis, Robert Polvmacher, Philip Vuc.
Knocking him out of the park.
This is a murderer. This is a murderer's row of names, guys. Just in terms of the challenging.
People, if your name is hard to pronounce, give us like phonetic something.
Give us a pronunciation guide. Philip Vukcevic, Steve Bennett, Isaac Kaufman, Mikko Usitalo again, and Simon Owens and Philippe Herrera for their contributions to the rate of $2 per month. If you want to support the Slash Filmcast, go to paypal.me and the word filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. I said that wrong again. Just if you want to support us and help defray the cost of seeing movies, go to slashfilm.com. Use the PayPal links on the side of the page. When you click on the tab /filmcast, we'd really appreciate it. All the money you help you donate goes to helping us put on the show. So thanks so much to all of our donors and subscribers this week. You guys are awesome. Hey guys, one last thing I wanted to mention before we get to our review. Any of you have a chance to see Twin Peaks this week?
Yes! My God.
One of the most insane and bold hours of television I've ever witnessed in my lifetime.
So do you come away appreciating that, Dave? Because I was really wondering as I was watching this, like, what would Dave be thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I appreciated the ballsiness of it. You know,
yes.
It's just so ballsy. But Jeff, I know you're not caught up. So like the closest analogy I can give is like, imagine if you were watching, let's see, The X-Files. Or what's another show you liked in the 90s?
That I liked in the 90s?
Yeah. Give me a show you like in the 90s.
What was on in the 90s?
I don't think you were watching TV in the 90s, Jeff, because all of our 90s touchstones you were not watching.
I was in college, so no, I wasn't watching TV in the 90s.
Okay, just give me a show you like, Jeff. Just give me a...
Shield.
Okay, imagine you're watching The Shield, okay?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, season 3, episode 8 of The Shield is the movie 2001 with characters from The Shield in the different roles.
Oh, all right.
You know, like... In terms of how visually striking it is, in terms of its relationship to the rest of the show, it's so out there and random and also beautiful and bold. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So
I loved it so much. It is definitely, like, to me, that is the most Twin Peaksiest thing they've done, which was in addition to, like, the 3 minutes of floor sweeping, which happened a couple weeks ago, too. But just the boldness of that and the beauty of it, too. I love the fact that we get to see David Lynch play with all of these new toys with CG and with like drone photography, which wasn't that sequence, but we're seeing that all over the show, too. So, yeah, man, I'm totally down with all of that.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. And yeah, I mean, it was absolutely nuts. And, you know, it was an episode. I went on the subreddit for Twin Peaks afterwards, and there was someone who wrote this, and it was so delightful. He said something along the lines of, like, oh man, I was starting to get I was starting to lose my creative spark a little bit, you know, and then I saw this episode and I thought to myself, maybe I can be creative again, you know, like it gave people actual hope for their lives, you know, that a major premium cable network paid for this to happen and millions of people saw it is crazy. Okay. Anyway, let's move on to our review of Baby Driver.
So you're just starting your day, or did you just get off?
They call, I go, you know.
So what is it you do?
I'm a driver.
Oh, like a chauffeur. Anyone I'd know?
I hope not.
What is your name?
Baby.
Your name's Baby. B-A-B-Y, Baby.
It's the one who say listen to the music all the time?
Is he mental?
Mental meaning slow. Was he slow?
No.
He had an accident when he was a kid. Still has a hum in the drum. Plays music to drown it out. And that's what makes him the best. Whoa, 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 whoa!
That was from the trailer of Baby Driver, the newest film by writer-director Edgar Wright. Plot summary from IMDb reads, partially, after being coerced into working for a crime boss, a young getaway driver finds himself taking part in one last heist. Jeff Cannata, you had a pretty good review of Baby Driver on your Twitter feed, right? You said this is a movie that would result if...
Yeah, let me just...
Go ahead, Jeff. Do it.
If Reservoir Dogs... and an OK Go video had a baby, that baby would be Baby Driver.
Oh. What did you mean by that, Jeff?
And if that doesn't sound good to you, you don't know what good is. OK Go, maybe that's a little outdated reference. They were sort of early 2000s.
Jeff, they're still releasing work pretty regularly. Yeah. Have you not seen their recent videos? They're pretty awesome.
I have. I keep up. I'm an OK Go.
Did you see the one that's like shot in slow motion? Like, it was amazing.
I saw the one where they did all on the vomit
plane.
Comet.
Yeah, but they did one.
Amazing.
They did one that was like all shot in slow motion. It was incredible. So that was like a couple months ago, Jeff. It was a couple months ago.
It was not a couple months ago, Dave. It was more than that. That was 2003. No, I'm just kidding.
Jeff is with it, guys.
I'm cool. I know what the kids watch. Reservoir Dogs. That's what I was watching. That's what I was watching in the 90s. Anyway, what I mean by that is it is kinetic and stylish. And I mean, the movie in a lot of ways borrows a lot of its style and its inspiration from music videos. And music videos themselves, I think, have kind of trended out. When I was young – music videos were a big deal, and I remember
they're still interesting, right? They're not as big a deal as they used to be, but people are still making really cool, interesting, kinetic music videos.
Yeah, but when a new single came out, it was right. a big deal to have the video. No, you know, not so mm-hmm. much. You find it on YouTube, and you're like, it's just a way to watch the song, listen to the
right,
song.
Right, right, yeah.
But OK Go, I think, is really is really bucking that trend and makes each of their new videos an event. And the choreography of it. I mean, this movie is...
And they're still making them, too. Anyway, go ahead, Jeff.
I swear to God. this movie is choreographed. I mean, there's a prominent credit at the beginning of the film that says choreographer. I mean, it is almost a musical, but a musical in mm-hmm. a way that no musical has ever been. It's a post-postmodern musical. It is mix culture done as a film. And it is still also a really cool heist movie and a really cool chase movie. And I think, Reservoir Dogs is a heist movie insofar as it's about the relationships between all the crazy, insane, scary people that live in this universe that do heists. And so is Baby Driver, but it also has the heart of sort of a sweet music video at its center. I loved it. I mean, it is it's so fun right from the beginning, and it knows exactly what it's doing. I'm one of those people, and I wonder if you two are as well. I'm one of those people that loves having my jam come on in the car, specifically in the car, all by myself in the car. I pop on my favorite song, or even better, when my favorite song comes on the radio on its own. Because it feels like it was synchronicity. It's synced up to my life, and I'm the windows down. It's a warm summer night. I'm driving fast, going home. The moon is out. My jam is on, and I start bopping around in my seat and lip syncing. And here comes the drop, and now here comes that line I love to say, and oh yeah, you know, like all of that stuff. Like that's the spirit. That's the backbone upon which this cool heist movie is laid. And there's such a joy in that moment. Like the whole beginning of this film just sweeps you up into that joy. And the movie is so stylized. Like I've never seen a gunfight choreographed as if it's percussion in a song. You know, it is literally the percussion of the song. And there's a fun in all of that, and then the story itself is really sweet. The actors that they have found in these two lead roles are really, really genuine feeling, and they have a wonderful chemistry. So I was swept up in that. Really, my only criticism is that I feel like from a car chase perspective, the movie shoots its best shots too soon. And it doesn't ever top itself. It's kind of got that James Bond flaw where, you know, the coolest action sequence happens in the first 10 minutes. But it more than makes up for that little bit of sadness with so much other fun, cool stuff and so much investment in the story. I just wish, like, by the end we had another really cool, grandiose car chase, but...
Yeah, I mean that's probably the thing that I feel like is the biggest weakness, or one of the weaknesses of the movie, is that the opening 15 minutes of this movie is so mind-blowingly good.
Yeah.
So ridiculously awesome and spectacular that the rest of the movie just doesn't live up to it, because it's – and I'm not saying that the rest of the movie is not good – but the opening is so good, guys. It's just so good.
It's perfect. It's like practically perfect.
There's people,
but that you keep waiting around for more of that.
Yeah.
It's like give me more of that.
Oh,
like,
I want to feel the way I felt when you showed me that thing at the beginning.
Yeah. That high again.
Oh, yeah. And people in my audience spontaneously bursting out into applause because some of the shots in that opening sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So spectacular. All right. Divinger Hardware, lay it on us.
Yeah, I love this movie too. So much style, so much energy. It's just like pure fun. And in a way, this movie feels like therapy to me. Like, it feels like this is how Edgar Wright is getting over Ant-Man. in a way. Like, you know what, guys? I fuck it. I just want to do something really fun. I want to make a really fun action movie. And this feels like an action musical, like what you were saying, Jeff. Yeah, I love everything about it. Like, there's so much technical craft. There's so much good stuff going on here. There are some long takes, as he's known for, that don't even involve driving, just baby walking down the street. And there's just so much going on in the background, that scene, the way it's all tied together. It feels like a Gene Kelly musical while also feeling like a Tarantino film and while also having some great chase sequences. So like it's more successful than like Drive as a driving action movie, because that movie had like one good chase scene and not really much action afterwards. At least this one has a lot of great action later on. There's a foot chase that I think is fantastic. Like one of the best we've seen in a very, very long time. Such a great music too. Like the entire movie.
I would say like 80 to 90% of the movie has music playing during it.
Yeah.
This is one of those movies where they clearly had to get the rights to the songs before they could start shooting.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure. It is basically a very long music video. But to me, it's also like, this is pure cinema, right? A lot of this, there's no dialogue. There's just like action and storytelling through action and character development through action. And I love all of that. There is some stuff I want to get into spoilers, because I think the last act is a little problem, like it's messy and it kind of, I think character motivations go out the window. I still really enjoy the overall experience, and I can't wait. Like, this is a movie I just can't wait to rewatch again and again, but the last act goes super messy.
I just, you know, to be clear, we're about to talk about spoilers in a second, and we will bring up a lot of issues with this movie, but I really enjoyed Baby Driver, and this is a movie I'm probably going to go see a couple more times. I've already seen it once. I might see it one or two more times.
Seen it twice. It's so good.
It's playing at the Cinerama in Seattle, which is like an amazing theater, and I cannot wait to go see it there.
I have to mention that I fortunately got to see it in Dolby Atmos, one of those really amazing, you know, high picture quality, high sound,
laser projection seat.
It was, and I just lucked into that. It just happened to be the time that I wanted, and my goodness, it couldn't have been a better decision, because this movie shines with great audio and great visuals for sure.
Yeah. By the way, that is, if you ever have a chance, if you have a Dolby theater near you, that is, just lean to that whenever you have a chance to do a screening there or see a movie there, just because they get everything just right. So good.
It costs a little extra, at least at the theater that I had. The ticket price is a little more for being in that screen, but it is worth every penny.
Before we jump to spoilers, just want to say a couple of things. I think Ansel Elgort, a guy I've liked in a couple of movies. I think he was in, what was it? One of those teen romance things.
He was in like the Divergent movies.
The Divergent movies, but also the one about the kids, the cancer kids dying.
Oh, Fault in Our
Stars.
That was
him.
I think that's also Divergence, isn't it?
That was also Divergence. That's why I felt like watching Divergence. But he is great in this movie. I love him so much. I finally get why everybody is really into him. And I love what Edgar Wright did with John Hamm. Like, John Hamm is playing like dirty 50s greaser in a way that is just like, it's very compelling. They've been like, apparently he had pitched John Hamm this movie a long while ago, like over 5 years ago, I think, and it took a while for it to come together, but John Hamm stayed on the project all the while, and I'm very glad for it. So I just want to say that
I think Lily James, who plays the female love interest in this movie, is just the perfect casting. She is so vulnerable, just looking the camera. She has an amazing vulnerability that I find to be perfect for this part. It is an inspired piece of casting, I think.
Mm-hmm. I do want to acknowledge, I mean, unfortunately, we don't have any women on this particular episode of the podcast, but I did see some tweets by Gabby Dunn the other night, who was very disappointed in this movie. And I just wanted to read off these tweets, because I think there are people who will have this point of view, and I think it's a very valid point of view. So this is Gabby Dunn tweeting on June 28th. Quote, "The main female character in Baby Driver spends the third act in the passenger seat, and that's basically how she's written for the whole film. I'm floored by how lazily written the women were. Intense Madonna/whore cliches, dead stereotypical woman of color, no interests/plans other than men's. True Romance is my favorite movie. It's messy and imperfect, but it never treats Alabama as useless and having no agency or life before Clarence. Spoiler, actual dialogue is the male lead asking the woman what her plans are the next day, and she says, whatever you're doing. She has no interests past agency or friends. She literally likes the music he likes and is chill with throwing her life away for a dude she kissed once.
That's a really strong point.
Yeah.
It's all very
true. I think
it's
totally valid, and I think the female characters in this movie are pretty weak. And that's just not the story that Edgar Wright is trying to tell in this movie. And I can understand why people are offended by it, you know?
Like, this movie is very much male wish fulfillment. Guillermo del Toro also had a great series of tweets about this, too, how you could read this movie allegorically, as sort of like a fable, you know, boy saving girl and things like that. But that problem is certainly there, and I wish it weren't.
Yeah, del Toro had this amazing tweet storm about this movie, right? Where he talked about, firstly, like, many, many directors have said that this movie is amazing. William Friedkin, right, director of The Exorcist, said that this movie is incredible. James Gunn said he's looking forward to seeing this movie. Guillermo del Toro on Twitter, quote, said, the key to understanding it fully is in the fact that it is a fable, complete with its very own Disney prince and princess, but it is also rock and roll, meaning the magic exists in a dirty, genre-tainted world. The film is incredibly precise, flawlessly executed to its smallest detail. Breathtaking Russian arm shots, real-world car mount and foot chases executed with the vigor and bravado of a Gene Kelly musical. This is an American in Paris on wheels and crack smoke. end quote.
That's
awesome. All that's true. All that's true. If you view it as a fable, then the lack of female character development is understandable.
No, it's still a problem.
But that's a very kind of outmoded way of telling stories. And some, like, you know, we've seen the handsome prince and beautiful princess being rescued story many, many times already, right?
And I actually think if you were talking about these sorts of movies as a fable, like Drive is very much a fable, like the hero and the big bad wolf and all those things. But that movie treats, you know, its women a lot better, I think, and a lot more interestingly.
I would say it's a mixed bag in terms of how Drive treats women, you know.
Better
good and bad in some ways, but anyway,
they have agency. And I think just because this movie is so focused on being Baby's story and being all about this journey and kind of his redemption in a way, that we didn't focus as much on the other people. I wish we did, because I could have spent so much longer in this world.
The other thing we should probably bring up as a flaw is, you know, we got this email from somebody criticizing the portrayal of tinnitus in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Jeff. I mean, I have some thoughts to say about that, but go ahead.
I don't have a problem with that necessarily. I can understand objecting to it if you're someone who's suffering from tinnitus and feel like that malady is misrepresented in the movie, as it certainly is. It's used as a device not based on its real function in the world. But I'm reminded of how I was forced to defend Split for the same thing in regards to dissociative personality disorder. And I think they're both kind of doing the same thing. Both of these movies are not about the thing. They use it in a fantastic way, and it's a jumping off point to tell a silly story that's not based in a real version of those problems.
I want to give voice to both of these opinions. Rob from Queens wrote into slashfromcast@gmail.com. He saw the movie at Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn. Devendra, have you been?
Most definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good theater.
It's very good, yeah.
So Rob wrote, thought the movie was entertaining, fun, and light, but I was left with something that was nagging me. For the past 11 years, I have had tinnitus in both ears, requiring me to wear hearing aids to hear somewhat normally. While my loss isn't quite as dramatic as some people, it often makes it difficult to recognize some speech or often talking in loud and crowded settings. What bothered me is that the movie isn't really interested in anything about someone with hearing loss. It seems to be window dressing so that Edgar Wright can play a lot of music, which, while it's entertaining, is really a little galling when you live with it. Not to mention that someone with tinnitus, and granted I'm not familiar with all cases, would largely not be helped by playing loud music, or at least it wouldn't function in the way the movie says it does. Baby can not only function while playing music, he can also pay attention and hear everything that's being said. Playing music would probably be more overwhelming than helpful to someone with that issue. End quote. So one correction, I think my understanding is the implication in the movie is that Baby can read lips.
I don't think it's implied, but I think that's a good explanation for why that's
very possible.
And also his adopted father is deaf too, so it's sort of like something he may have learned.
Right. It's also I thought that Merrill Barr wrote something very interesting. He wrote basically the opposite of what Rob wrote to us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Merrill Barr tweeted last night, "Baby Driver is a movie about a main character with something called tinnitus. Let me start here. When you have tinnitus, you're always hearing a constant ringing, not unlike what you hear in the shell shock scenes in Saving Private Ryan. The volume of the ringing is mild to severe, depending on different circumstances. However, what it ultimately means is the concept of silence is lost on you. Imagine that. Imagine never being able to experience true quiet ever, not ever knowing what it sounds like. A lack of silence means you often want to go in the opposite direction to compensate. You want to hear noise all the time, because the alternative sucks. The best way to do this is with music. Now imagine this. Imagine living your life with music or a podcast blasting in your ears almost every minute of the day. Not because you want to, but because you have to all the time. It warps your perception of the world. Music inherently heightens everything. It makes something as simple as walking down the street more epic. When Baby's walking down the street to get coffee and starts breaking out into random dance for no reason, I identified with that in a way I didn't know I could identify with something on screen. I've done this. To a lesser extent than Baby. You get lost in the music because that heightened world is as second nature to you as the human voice. The rest of the world looks at you like a crazy person because to them, listening to music is a choice. It's an escape. This is where one of the criminals gets their reading of Baby wrong. The music is not an escape. For Baby, it's basically medication to make him a functional person, not consumed by the distraction he has naturally. It wouldn't play on screen, but tinnitus makes it hard to sleep to. Baby probably has serious insomnia, music day in and day out, isolating you, but also coloring your world in a unique shade no one else is living. This is how I've always seen the world, and I literally watched an action hero version of myself with better music taste in that movie. It was fucking awesome. So yeah, thanks for this one, Edgar Wright. I'd hug you if I could.
Nice. Okay.
So that's a very different opinion of how tinnitus is treated.
I'm glad Merrill, who I've talked to for a while on Twitter as well, I used to know him in New York, I'm glad that actually this rendering of tinnitus actually holds true for some people, and it shows like how these things just are different for different people.
Yeah, indeed. All right, let's get the spoilers for Baby Driver starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're gonna see this coming.
No,
but you won't find it because, of course,
you're not gonna see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
Okay.
Okay.
What is up with that Kevin Spacey shit?
Like,
The idea that Kevin Spacey, who earlier in the movie was threatening to kill Baby and all of his family, would now just have a sudden about face at the end, I found to be pretty unbelievable.
Because he was in love once, you see, and he saw them together. So it's all.
I don't know. I liked it.
Did you find it believable, Jeff, or did you just like it?
I liked it because it was an unexpected twist that he's not. We expected the showdown to be with him and the guy that has been super cool to Baby the whole movie, i.e., John Hamm, Buddy, is really the danger. I thought that was a fun flip, and I didn't. This isn't a movie where character motivation is a big deal. It really feels heightened.
It does feel like kind of a big deal, though. Like this. After I'm enjoy, I enjoy the movie all the way through.
Believable? You think that Kevin Spacey is believable at any point in the movie?
It doesn't matter. Like, if he has to be believable within the universe of this movie, right? That's how genre filmmaking works. And I can believe Kevin Spacey is this guy who like plans these heists and like gathers these crews and makes bank off of it and is like king of Atlanta. And also, we didn't talk about Atlanta and how great it is that this movie is shot on location and uses all those streets. But it's not true to the character to me when we make this change at the end. Like, he was always cool to Baby while threatening him, but this complete, like, oh, you're in love, so I'm going to throw my life away to defend you now, didn't seem right. And I think part of the, especially watching the movie a second time, part of the thing is, too, like, there are a lot of motivational issues, I guess, throughout, right? They give Baby a way to leave the deal. And even Kevin Spacey wants out of the deal after that shit goes down with the cops. And Kevin Spacey's like, I don't want to do this. And Baby could just walk away at that point. And I think he'd be scot-free. And I don't even know why he sticks with it. Because as he does that, and then they find all his tapes, and they go beat up his adopted father. Like, it's... There are things that happen in this movie, especially towards the end, I don't know why they happen, and that takes away some enjoyment.
Yeah. Why does Baby, like, they say, oh, well, Baby, it's up to you. And Baby says, well, I think we should continue on with this heist. Yeah.
He has no reason to want.
Yeah, he could have just said, let's call it off, and then...
Easy out. Yeah, he, and then everybody walks away.
Left. Maybe it's because he needed the money from the heist to flee? He was going to run away that night, right?
Yeah, so. And he had a stack of money. Like, it's... Yeah. There was no motivation there. The Kevin Spacey thing kind of comes out of the blue. And I think, like, the John...
Kevin Spacey was the moment I knew that we're in a very specific kind of movie is when Kevin Spacey is given a speech and then stops and goes, I just drew that while I was talking. How fucking cool is that? It's like, okay, well, he's basically talking to the audience.
And I think that was one take, by the way. I need to rewatch that, but I think that was one take where we were just watching him talk and as he was drawing, and I think he did just like scrawl the whole thing out. But yeah, it's very heightened. It's just, I wish even within that heightened reality, it'd be nice if the characters kind of, you could have had Kevin Spacey do that thing and give it more motivational grounding. That's all.
Speaking of things I kind of wish there had been more of, I wish there was more of this world than what this movie depicts. I mean, Kevin Spacey's this guy who does heists, but I never really got a true feeling of there being anything beyond this guy who's just kind of a mastermind at this stuff, you know? Like, an example of a movie that does a quote-unquote good job of this is the John Wick series. Perhaps they take it a little too... Like, with John Wick, it's like, oh, by the way, there's a whole society of homeless people that are assassins, you know? Like,
or yeah, that's a good thing.
There's a whole society of blank that are blank, you know? And it's not really believable, but you get a sense that, oh, we're only seeing 3% of this whole universe right now. And I never felt that way with Baby Driver. Is that I felt like we're seeing pretty much the whole universe, you know, in this
movie.
Know.
I mean, I wouldn't say that because the movie is so specifically about Baby and kind of his journey. And it feels very personal in a way. It feels like this is Edgar Wright kind of wearing his heart on his sleeve. And I'm sure there's more he could do to expand this world. But the way we're focused on it right now, like these random criminals who come in and each have their own personalities. Love John Bernthal. Love Jamie Foxx. Like we understand the rules of a heist movie. But I guess what you're saying is true. Like this could very well just be like a Grand Theft Auto universe, right? Where there are virtual walls around everything and nothing greater is happening outside of it. I don't know if I needed
who is, you know, I don't know if maybe it's if I'm used to it or I'm conditioned to it or if it actually would make the movie better, but who is Kevin Spacey working for? What is he doing with all this money? You know, like
the man.
I'm just. It's not that it makes the movie worse or in any way that these questions aren't answered. I'm just like, I wonder what the movie would have been like if there was a bigger world out there that you feel like you're only scratching the surface of.
I could kind of see that, but what I really love is the fact that this movie is shot in Atlanta, and they actually set it in Atlanta, and you see a lot of familiar streets. There's that crazy, winding bunch of highways called Spaghetti Junction, which is insane, just insane to drive through, and setting a chase movie even around there is kind of fascinating. So I think I love that it has an actual sense of place, and I guess it felt grounded in a world that was like, we are in the city, and there's this crazy stuff happening, and... Yeah, in Reservoir Dogs, you don't see really what's happening outside of those dudes and that, you know, supposed bank thing.
I had a problem. I totally agree with you guys about the moment where they're like, Baby, it's up to you. Do we do it or not do it? There's zero reason for him to say do it. Zero.
Well, we gotta climax this action movie.
Yeah,
right.
It felt very weird.
Didn't want to draw suspicion to him. So.
But yeah, but it's also weird that he leaves it up to Baby. Like
Kevin Spacey. Yeah, that is weird too. But Kevin Spacey wants an out, and Baby has an out, and he doesn't take it. And then
it's weird.
It's super weird.
But the other thing that I wanted to bring up too is that maybe this is a minor nit, but we watched them like take down armored trucks and walk away with, you know, duffel bags full of cash and split up all that money. the big last job that's worth all the risk with these people that distrust each other greatly is the post office. And the
post office is bank. That is actually – I found that ingenious because there's a shit ton of money at the post office. And those
they're not stealing money.
They're stealing the money, but that's all true. They have a magical machine that literally prints money because it prints the money orders. Yeah.
But it's like a two-step process. So like these guys are like, okay, we're going
to – They have the machine, Jeff. Come on.
No, they don't. They have a guy who has the machine.
Yeah, they have a guy who has the machine.
Who has a nose problem.
It's very convoluted, but I found it kind of –
The point I'm trying to make is that – that they're willing to make this big risk and stick it out one more night, mm-hmm. even though the heat is on them, to get this paper that is worthless to them, and they'll have to hang out while they go to some other dude. And even when they're like, oh, John Hamm's character has a guy, so now we're going to have to wait for that guy to magically convert it into actual dollars and that we're going to split up. And so, it felt so weird that they would take – this is the job that we're going to all risk everything for. It's
a little too complex, I guess, or not exciting enough for a one last job, you're saying?
Yeah, it didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense.
They basically pulled a heist on the most heavily guarded post office in the country, I think.
No, it was one guard, and then shit just kind of hit the fan.
Let me ask you guys this. I found the very, very end of this movie to be really bizarre.
I agree.
My thinking is that it was Edgar Wright's way of giving these people a happy ending, free and clear. Right. Mm-hmm. If he had just driven off with her, they would have lived happily ever after. But they would have been looking over their shoulder for the rest of their lives. But
ending, that he actually has to pay for his crimes in some way. Like that's an honest, and you don't ever see that in movies where they actually have to go and have some. There are some consequences. But the most unbelievable thing in this movie, in a lot of unbelievable things, is that she would wait 5 years for him.
Why is that unbelievable? It's true love, Jeff.
It's true love. I almost feel like watching that scene a second time.
No, Jeff. Yeah. Jeff, why is it unbelievable?
There is no such thing as a person waiting around 5 years for somebody that's in jail.
That is not true at all, Jeff. Have you ever seen Orange Is the New Black?
Oh, another fictional thing? Oh, yeah.
No, sure, but I mean,
maybe they had an arrangement and she,
you mean the show based on a true story? Yes, Jeff. I mean,
where the guy cheats on her with her best friend.
Okay, well, all that stuff is fake, but the idea, the woman, Piper, whatever her name, Piper Chapman going to jail, that was a real thing. Anyway. Lots of people wait for people in jail. Okay, yes, you're right. They were married. But, Baby and what's-her-name were basically married
in
this movie.
Did that last scene even happen? Like, that's the thing. I'm rewatching it the second time. I guess it's shot in a way that's like one of his dream sequences. But
it goes,
I guess,
to color. It transforms from black and white to color, so that means it's real.
But the color still looks like it's set in the 50s. Like, it's their costuming, her costuming and everything. It still feels a little off. I almost wonder if, like, did we flash forward 5 years, or is this just like a happy dream of his?
His after he like touches the he's lost his hearing, and he touches the speaker.
How sad was that?
The speaker, right? Feels the music from his mom, right?
Yeah. That kind of got me. But all this ending stuff, I actually do think it's unique to have your hero kind of pay for his crimes, and he got off a little light too, even though he had to be in jail for several years because like he had some good behavior things, or people talked about how good he was to them.
That was a beautiful moment, by the way. I just have to say that really choked me up because – For the one time in cinema, it's like, oh, being a good person matters for something. It actually counts. Trying to do the right thing and having an impact on sort of peripheral people actually matters. I just loved that sentiment that the movie professes at the end is, oh, hey, little things that you do to other human beings actually matter. And I think it needs to be said more in today's world.
Mm-hmm. I almost wonder if it would have been if they had just driven off, and even though they would never know if they're safe, like that actually thematically seems to fit better too, because the movie kind of grinds to a little halt to do all this final stuff. So I don't know. I just found that a little odd. And the fact that he just becomes super action hero dude, like when he's not driving, like after he kills Jamie Foxx, impales him, doesn't really react to that, and then like we're off on like a Jason Bourne foot chase. That there's a lot of stuff happening at the end. I'm like, okay, I see what you're trying to do, movie, and I'm having fun with it. But if I stop to think about why this is happening or why this character can do this and why he's pulling off headshots, yeah, then it becomes a little less enjoyable, I guess.
All right. Well, despite those nits, I think it's a movie that we still really enjoyed. It just, yeah, there's some really strange decisions that were made in the final, I would say, 15 minutes of the movie that just, we're bringing up and chatting, talking out.
But guys, that first 15 minutes of the movie?
Oh.
you'll never have that high back again.
the moment where he goes under the overpass and forces that car to switch places with him.
Oh, so good.
Is so badass.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that there would be two identical red cars to his there is a little contrived, but I forgave it immediately because of how badass moment was.
That one e-brake, reverse e-brake turn, which is, it's in the trailer, so a lot of people have seen it, but it still works so well. And this movie, entirely practical, car chases. Like, there's no CG going on here.
Yeah,
so it all feels really great and grounded.
I feel like somebody went to the stunt driver and said, what is the coolest thing you can do with a car? And
well, if the road was a little wet.
Yeah.
Just slight a little. That's super cool. Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, that's our review of Edgar Wright's Baby Driver, a movie we enjoyed. We'd recommend you check it out. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. You can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our music comes from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper is from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. In the meantime, Jeff Cannata, where can I find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, if you want to hear me talk about video games, I have two opportunities for you. I have a weekly video game show called DLC that I do with a co-host and a guest every week on 5x5. That's 5x5.tv/DLC. And I have a daily show called Newest, Latest, Best that's on Anchor and is now available as a podcast. So you can find that on iTunes and on Google Play. So search for Newest, Latest, Best, or my own name, Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I also do a comedy science show called We Have Concerns that you can find at wehaveconcerns.com.
How about you, Devendra?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at Engadget.com.
Find all my stuff at DaveChen.net, including my review of Master of None Season 2. Next week, we'll be reviewing Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh, yeah.
Devendra and I have seen it. We loved it. We can't wait to talk about it. And I'm pretty sure Jeff is going to lose his damn mind when he's...
It's going to be an episode. Like the direct opposite of our emotions during the Transformers episode. It'll be that.
Let's hope so. Now we've built... The hype is so big now. Can it possibly live up to it? We'll be back next week with Spider-Man Homecoming. Thanks for listening to the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. We're out.